We're starting a new series today, a 9-week series on change. So if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? One thing. And you have to answer for yourself and not for the person sitting next to you. Most of us actually struggle with this question, not because we can't think of something we'd like to change, but because we have so many things we would like to change, right? So how do we prioritize? Which one do I do first? All sorts of things that I'd like to change. And oh, by the way, if you're sitting here and you're thinking, I don't think I need to change anything, I'm fine the way that I am, we just invite you to come for the rest of this series. You know, here's one thing that I'd like to change about myself. I am constantly and always overextending myself relationally. That's one thing I'd like to change. I think I'm, by default, more of a people pleaser. Any people pleasers in the room? Anybody? Yeah? So raise your hands high. We please people. You know, sometimes that's a little hard, right? I mean, I bend over backwards. I can bend over backwards to make people happy, even when it is at great cost to myself or to my family. When I have to say no to someone, I stress out about it. Kicks up my anxiety. Now, don't get me wrong. I'd love to be connected with all of you. In fact, I'd love to have a meeting with every single one of you if I could. If I could fill all of my days with meetings with every single one of you, I mean, I would do it. I would totally do it. Every single person in this church to have a one-hour meeting once a week. I would do it. I would do it. I would totally do it. It's something that I want to do. I mean, like, in fact, I know that even though there's like a thousand people at this church, I mean, like, I want to meet with all of you, which sounds kind of crazy. I mean, like, when I think about not being able to do it, it actually stresses me out a little bit. So now if you, like, say, hey, Ted, can we have a meeting? I'd say, man, I would love to do that, but then it'd probably be like 3 months out. Some of you have tried to have meetings with me, and then we got a meeting on the schedule, and then something happened, something came up, so we had to cancel the meeting. And then it took 3 months to get the other meeting. I mean, I wish it wasn't like that. And so I'm trying to figure that out. I mean, don't get me wrong. I want to be connected with all of you, but I'm trying to figure out how to be healthy in all of that. I'd like to change. Like, changing ourselves, or what maybe the secular world might call self-improvement, is so basic to our human personalities that you can even see that what makes a person a human is that they want to change. I mean, how many of you want to change something about yourself? Yeah, I know that I do. I know that we all do. What makes humans human is that they want to change themselves, which is why we have New Year's resolutions. How many of you have New Year's resolutions? How many of you do those? Nobody does anymore. Because you go, oh, I've given up. Like, I used to set New Year's resolutions, and then after like a couple weeks, I totally forgot about them. You know, like, and then I would think, no, I don't believe in that stuff. And my parents were here earlier in the first service, and they would ask me about my New Year's resolutions and tell me, we think that you need them. And I would be like, okay. But I don't believe in them. I don't believe that they work. But then, you know, 5 years later, I'd be thinking, maybe I should do that again because I want to change, right? We have dieting fads. So we love to change so much that we want to diet. How many of you have been on a diet before? Anyone? Don't raise your hand necessarily. I mean, like, I'm just saying. And then you get on a diet and you think, man, that doesn't work. But then you think, maybe this diet would work. Or maybe this diet would work. That we want to change is why we have mindfulness apps. Anybody have a mindfulness app on your phone? Yeah, and you've got a mindfulness app on your phone that you pay. You pay your phone to keep you mindful, right? Because you want to change. You want to change, right? Like, this is at the core of us is that we want to change. I think it's probably like wired in us that we want to change. And if we're honest, most of us, when it comes to real personal change, feel powerless. I mean, we don't know how to change ourselves. And if we do, it takes like so much effort. And then even at the end, it's easy to backslide, right? So we want to talk about change because change is at the heart of what it means to be a Christian person. Like, we talked about it last week. We talked about how Jesus accepts us as we are, but doesn't want us to stay where we are. We're commanded to change. The scriptures tell us that we are to be conformed to the image of Jesus, as Romans 8:29 tells us. And the Apostle Paul, by the way, has no illusions that that conforming isn't a lifelong process. And so that you can imagine, if you were in a room with a bunch of pastors, which most of you, I don't think, have had the misfortune of being. I have many times. I'm with pastors all the time. And we always talk about change. We're always talking about, what does it look like to help people change? We're obsessed with it. We're always looking for ways to help people unlock the kind of Christ-like change that is the highest good of every single person. So we're talking about how do we help people thrive? How do we do that? What are we doing in our churches? What are we doing? How are our churches like structured or built so that people can actually become more like Jesus? Because we want everyone to thrive. And so behind all this change are theories of change. So we have, I know it's kind of technical, but behind changing, especially in the Christian world, we have these theories of how change can actually happen. How can we participate in the life of the Spirit who changes us? I heard a theologian recently talk about a few different kinds of theories of change. Here are a few he mentioned. Number one, he mentioned a sacramental theory of change. In other words, the sacramental theory of change says that we change if we participate in church. If we partake of the elements of the church's liturgical practice, if we take communion, if we get baptized, we worship, if we're there on Sundays, if we're praying the written out prayers that the church has prayed for centuries, we will change. So that's one theory of change. Here's another that the theologian mentioned, an informational theory of change. Anybody familiar with that one? That one basically says you get more information in you, then you'll change. So all you need to change is to have the right kind of information. If you know the right thing to do, you'll be a different person. How many of you have heard that before? Anyone? Yeah, if you know the right thing, you'll be the different kind of person, right? Well, here at the Vineyard, this isn't a theory of change that the theologian mentioned, but here at the Vineyard, I mean, I think you've heard that, or maybe you've kind of felt that we have like this underlying sort of operative theory of change here at the Vineyard, and maybe you've heard this before, maybe you've kind of like felt it, and that thinking goes like this. You get ambushed or you get overcome by the Spirit in a powerful manifestation of power, and then you'll change. Anybody heard that one before? I don't know, anybody felt that before? Yeah, sure. Like, I have no real issue with these three theories of change, but I think they're incomplete. So, like, when it comes to the sacramental theory of change, I think that we do need the sacraments. We need the presence of Christ in the elements of our services or our liturgies. We need communion. We need to do it. That's why we do it every week. We need to experience the presence of Christ as we take communion together. We need to pray prayers written hundreds of years ago. But this theory of change has not borne up so well under the long history of the church. Like, many of us have sat in long church services that were more sacramental or high church in nature, and they've done little to change our hearts. In fact, after a while, for those of us who've been in these church settings, if you pray the same prayers over and over again, you've become so familiar with them that they cease to become meaningful. More than that, we know people who've been to churches like this weekly for years who aren't really all that different. And if we're honest, we might be some of those people ourselves. And here's the other thing. When it comes to information, information's incomplete too. Information and theory of change, yeah, we need information. We need the truth. But this theory of change assumes that the mind is the primary place we experience change. So if we change our minds, we'll change everything else about us. But now, like, the journey from the head to the heart, we know, I mean, even though it's like physiologically like a foot and a half, for most of us, head to heart seems like miles, doesn't it? Like, we might know that God loves us, but few of us actually experience that love in our hearts. Informational theory of change is incomplete as well. And here's another reason why information fails to change us. Science tells us that information doesn't work so well. All right, so as we learn more about our brains, we know that you've heard this before, right brain, left brain stuff. Who's heard that before, right brain, left brain? You've heard that the right brain is your artistic side, right? And then you've heard that your left brain is your more analytic side. So we say you're more right brain or you're more left brain. Anybody heard that before? Anybody been told that they're more right brain or left brain? Yeah, sure, of course. It's in the water, right? Well, what neuroscience has learned is that that left brain, right brain kind of dichotomy, at least the way that I just talked about it, it's not really true. The left brain is the slow, intentional side of our brains. This is the side of your brain that thinks carefully before you do something. The right side of the brain is the side of your brain that's more automatic. It's like your automatic response or reaction to things that are happening, like in the moment, right? It's the side that causes you to jump out of the way, like when you step out on the street and you see an oncoming car. You don't have to like use your left brain to say, get out of the way. You just do it, right? So that's like your automatic side of your brain is your right side of your brain. Guess how much happens on the right side of your brain in your life? 90% of what you do, you don't really think about. 90%, that's what science tells us. Science tells us that 90% of what you do, you don't actually think about ahead of time. So information is all well and good if you are mostly left-brained, but we're not. Most of what we do is automatic. How many of you brushed your teeth this morning and had to think about it? You know, you were like, that's just what you do. Some of you are thinking, did I do that today? And you're like, I think I did. And you run your tongue over your teeth and go, eh. You know, I mean, like, you didn't actually think about it. Like, we have these routinized habits that we don't think about that happen to us automatically. Well, your right brain is the driver. And the problem with information is that it doesn't really affect your right brain. So when you want to change, you think 90% of what I do is automatic, then we need something else than information, because information only really helps us in our left brains. And finally, here in this third theory of change, this kind of spirit, overcoming work of the spirit, I believe in all that, by the way. I have been overcome by the spirit. I love being overcome by the spirit. I love being laid out by the spirit. But I'm sure that you know people who have had those experiences that have not really changed. Well, we need the fast, powerful work of the Spirit of God to overcome us and overtake us. Yes, we need that. And we will pray for it all day long. But we also need the slow daily work of the Spirit if we are to change. So none of these theories of change are wrong. We need all of them. But here at the Vineyard, here at the Evanston Vineyard, we want to say that there's a different overarching theory of change that we want to introduce to you over the next 9 weeks. And it's a theory of change that touches us where we can really change. And where is that? That's our hearts. Heart change. In fact, heart change is the third theory of change that the theologian I mentioned earlier proposed. He called it an Augustinian theory of change, named after the North African Bishop Augustine from the 300s and 400s, who said, "My love is my weight. I'm carried by it where I'm carried." In other words, my love is the thing that carries me in the certain direction that I need to go. Love points our lives to its object. And so when you want to change, you want to change your brain, even though our brains need to change, especially our right brains, you want to change your heart. Heart change is why Jesus asked his disciples about their desires and not necessarily their beliefs. This is when Jesus is followed by the first two disciples in John 1. His question is not, what do you know or what do you believe, but what do you want? Verse 35, the next day John was there again with two of his disciples. When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, "Look, the Lamb of God." When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you," everyone say it with me, "want?" This is also why Jesus tells us, "For where your treasure is, there your," everyone, "heart will be also." And why the writer of Proverbs tells us, "Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Everything that you do flows from your heart. So when it comes to the core of your personality or your identity, it's probably not a surprise for me to tell you that you are not just what you know or not just what you believe, but primarily you are what you love. Everything you do flows from your heart, which is why Jesus says this to the teacher or the religious insider who comes and asks him, what is the greatest commandment of the law? Jesus says, it's love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Love the Lord, love your neighbor. So when it comes to change, what needs to happen in order for us to change is not change the way we think, even though that needs to change, but change the way we desire, change the way that we love. So when it comes to discipleship, which is the word that we use in Christian circles for change, the process by which we change discipleship, this is a way that we want to think about. We want to think about discipleship in a way that it's related to the heart. So when I think about discipleship as a way to train our hearts to be attentive to and intentional about what you love. One scholar tells us, discipleship is more about hungering and thirsting than of knowing and believing. By the way, in no way am I saying that we don't need the truth. We absolutely do need the truth. Jesus is the truth. But when it comes to change, what this scholar is saying and what we are saying, man, change has to happen here. Jesus' command to follow him is a command to align our loves and longings with his, to want what God wants, to desire what God desires, to hunger and thirst after what God hungers and thirsts for, and to crave after his kingdom. In other words, Jesus doesn't just change our minds, he changes our love. Which is really good news, because if it's actually true that we are what we love, and Jesus is attentive to that, we need to change our hearts. And he knows that. We need our loves to be formed or shaped, which is why you may hear us use this word formation. Anybody heard us use that word before? It's just another word for discipleship. We just like the word formation because we want you to unconsciously think of your loves being formed. And oftentimes discipleship, especially in the last 20 to 30 years, has mostly been about getting you to know the right things. Because there was an underlying assumption, underlying theory of change under that, which was basically if we got you to know the right things, then you would do the right things. How many of you have known what the right thing is to do and didn't do it? And you were like, I know what the right thing is to do. I am just not going to do it. Anybody ever know that before? I mean, like, getting the right amount of knowledge doesn't actually help us to change. We have to actually want to act on that knowledge. And, well, how do we change our wanter? How do we change our hearts? Love. And when you think about love, love is directed somewhere, right? It has to be directed to someone. We don't just need love because we love lots of things, don't we? We love cats. Some of us do. We love dogs. We love people. We love ice cream. I mean, like, I love ice cream in a way that my life is organized around eating ice cream. So I wake up in the morning, I think about when do I need to go to the store to buy the ice cream that I will eat later. And even when I don't think about eating ice cream, someone hands me ice cream to eat, what do? Well, I don't turn it down, I eat it. Right? My loves can be ordered around ice cream. And I know that's kind of a silly example, but you know what I mean. Love has to be pointed to its proper object. So in order for us to change, you can't just have more love. You need love to be pointed to the proper object. And who is that object? Well, it's the crucified King of love, Jesus. Remember, Jesus tells us that the greatest commandment isn't just love. All we need is love. Well, that's not true. You need love that's rightly ordered. He's like, well, no, this is what rightly ordered love is. It's when the Lord our God is the first object of our love. And here's where the neuroscience comes back in. So you think that, well, information will train your left brain. Well, how do you train your right brain? Well, neuroscience tells us that the way that you train your right brain is actually love. You learn how to act properly in your right brains through attachment or love, which is why desire is so powerful. Desire is this powerful tool that reigns in our right brains because desire is all about attachment. And when you can attach to God, there is power. So how do we do that? How do we... Well, like, and maybe you're sitting here and you're thinking, okay, I'm in. I've tried all sorts of different kinds of ways of change, and you're presenting a different kind of theory of change. I'm in. How do I do that? Well, how do we make God our proper object? How do we make God the object of our loves? How do we make God the first object of our loves? By the way, we're not saying that loving ice cream is a bad thing. We're not saying that. We're just saying that when it is the first thing in your life, maybe you should reconsider your priorities. This is about rightly ordered love. This is about love that has God as its primary object. What we are saying here at the Vineyard and here in Scriptures, or in the Scriptures, what the Scriptures are also affirming is that when God becomes a proper object of our loves, we actually can change. And so how do we do that? Well, we do that by becoming like Jesus. Because Jesus is the only one who walked this earth who had rightly ordered love all of the time. Every single minute, every second of the day, and even through the night, love for his Father was first. He always put his Father first, and he still puts his Father first eternally. He is good utterly. He spoke the truth. He is the truth. You remember that he is the way, the truth, and the life. Well, what does it mean to be the way, the truth, and the life? Well, it doesn't just mean that he's the way to the Father. No one comes to the Father except through me. Yeah, I know that verse. Yes, that is true. But it's not just that he is the way to the Father. He's also the way of life that every Christian person has as their highest good. So if you want to live a life that is properly organized and ordered in that God is its first object, well, then you do it like Jesus did. It's his life that's our way of life. And that's why Peter tells us in his first letter, to this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Become like Jesus. So here we are at the beginning of a 9-week series of change, and we return where we return every year in the summer to this idea that change happens when we become like Jesus. I mean, you may have heard over the next 9 weeks, you'll probably hear stuff that you've heard before, and that's deliberate, because becoming like Jesus is our highest priority for each one of you, because it is our highest good. And so how do we become like Jesus? Well, we do it like we would become like anybody else. We spend time with them. We copy them. We imitate them. We do it the same way we might to our heroes. Or people that we look up to. We like do the same things that they do. So we want to become like Jesus, and in so doing, order our love so that God is first and attached to God. We'll become like Jesus and do the things that Jesus did. As Dallas Willard puts it, we can become like Christ by doing one thing, by following him in the overall style of life he chose for himself. So we can become like Christ by doing the same things that he did. And the good news is that we have 4 books in Scriptures and more that tell us about Jesus' life. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John tell us about his ministry. They tell us about Jesus, what he said, the miracles he performed. They tell us about his death. They tell us about his resurrection. They tell us about his ascension. They tell us that he lived in glorious light. But they also tell us how he lived his private life too. And I guess what we're saying is that if you want to become like Jesus, why don't you do it in your private life, not just in your public life? Why don't you do the things he did in his private life? Because maybe if you do that, you would change. In fact, we're saying that if you do that, you will change. And so what did Jesus do privately? Well, Luke 5:16 tells us that Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and, everyone, he prayed. He had a prayer life. He practiced solitude. Jesus also prayed for other people too. In John 17:9, we read, I, Jesus, pray for them. I'm not praying for the world, but for those you've given me, for they are yours. So he prays for other people as well. And how many of you in your prayer life are kind of like, man, I've prayed and that's like 2 minutes and I've got, I just don't know what else to pray for. Anybody have that experience before? Like, I think I'm going to sit down and I'm going to pray for a little bit. And you're like, man, I prayed for a long time. And you look at the clock and it's like 2 minutes have gone. And you thought, man, I've got all my little requests out. What am I going to do now? Well, why don't you pray for someone else? Why don't you let your prayer time be filled with the saints as Jesus' prayer life is? By the way, did you know Jesus still prays for you and me? Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life, is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. That's Romans 8:34. That's the Apostle Paul. How many of you are glad that Jesus prays for you? Anyone? Anyone? Yeah. I'm glad that Chris Herning prays for me. But I'm even gladder that Jesus does. You know, and he prays for you too, Chris. He prays for you. I imagine that if we were like talk show together, you and me, Chris, I don't know if you'd be the host, but one of us would be sitting on the couch, you know, and we'd be like, what do you think? Yeah, what do you think? Jesus prays for you. He prays for you. He makes intercession for you. And the good thing about his prayers is he knows the heart of God. So he prays for you exactly what you need. In fact, the scriptures also tell us that Jesus knew his Bible really well. When Jesus was in the desert, he was tempted by the devil and he answered each temptation with the scriptures. It was clear he didn't have to look it up. Just had it from memory. It wasn't like the tempter comes and says to him, if you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. And Jesus answers, I know there's something. It's in the book. And hang on a second. Let me just look it up for a second. There's something about bread and what is it? No, he knew it. He was immersed in it. It almost like came from his lips, like it was part of him. Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. I imagine that for 40 days and 40 nights, that verse was in his heart. And by the way, 40 days and 40 nights, he also fasted. We know that he fasted. We know that he knew his Bible. We know that he prayed. We know that he did lots of other things too. And we want to talk about those things over the next 8 weeks. It turns out that the things that Jesus did in his private life were the things that maybe you, if you've been around church for a while, you've heard are called spiritual disciplines. Anybody heard that before? Spiritual disciplines. I mean, whoever came up with that name, disciplines, like here, let's give you some disciplines to do. And you're like, how about some fun? You know, like, no, it turns out that the things that Jesus did in his life are actually the things that we, the church, has historically named spiritual practices or disciplines. And what we want you to do is we want you to do over the next 8 weeks, what we want to do together is say, leaning into this theory of change, that change needs to happen at the level of the heart, and that heart change best happens as we become like Jesus. And that becoming like Jesus actually happens as we do the things that Jesus did. Well, over the next 8 weeks, we're going to give you all sorts of stuff that Jesus did. And what we want to ask you to do is pick one or two of them and say, I'm going to do this for the rest of the year. You just pick one or two, and I'm going to do them. And don't just pick the ones you really want to do. Pick also the ones that you're like, I really don't want to do that. Because sometimes he leads you through resistance. Spiritual practices or disciplines didn't just come from a monk's or nun's idea. They came from the life of Jesus. His life was full of these formational spiritual practices. And so the reason why here at the Vineyard, we really love formation and we love spiritual practices and we talk about them every year is because Jesus did them. And in doing them, we believe that the hopeful future for every single person is if they do them, they will actually change. In fact, for the next like eight weeks or 9 weeks or so, as you hear these different voices that are going to talk about spiritual practices, and as maybe you pick one or two that you want to do and commit yourself to, we're going to also locate these practices in our congregational values, because our congregational values are the way that we think about embodying the life of Jesus as a church. And so you're going to hear a different practice that Jesus did. You're going to hear about how to do that practice, but you're also going to hear about how it relates to what we think about when it comes to the life of the church. So every one of these practices are associated with our congregational values. And so let's review our congregational values now, shall we? You guys remember when we did this six-week series on congregational values? I see Emmy's face. Emmy's over there smiling. Emmy, you want to come up on stage and give them to us? Six? No, I'm kidding. Chris is going to do that for us. All right, our six values, our six congregational values. All right, the first one is worshiping the true and beautiful God. That was Jesus' life. The second value that we have is balancing the word and spirit. The third value we have is becoming like Jesus. The fourth value we have is being an emotionally healthy community. And why do we care about that? Because we believe that Jesus was the most emotionally healthy person to walk planet Earth. Number five is doing restorative justice, which was Jesus' life on mission. Isn't this why Jesus came? To restore God's original intention for his good creation. And finally, our last value is embracing the future. How do we embrace the future? Well, we embrace the Lord of history, who will not be thwarted by any moment in the future. His will be done. And so over the next 9 weeks, we want to invite you into our values, but also into these practices, because we want to invite you to thrive and to change. And two more things as we close that I would just want to say. Two really important things. First of all, so we're talking about loving attachment. We're talking about attaching to God. And the one thing that I want to say is I want to say that when we think of spiritual disciplines or practices, oftentimes we think of doing them alone, don't we? So you think about like waking up like really early, if we're holy. Or like going, maybe we're not morning people because we're not as holy, so we do it at night. I'm just kidding. You can do it whenever. You know, but maybe we think about like waking up really early or going really late at night, and we think that, man, I'm going to do these spiritual practices and I'm going to do them alone. Well, that's never how God intended it. God always intended for us to do these practices together. You know, when the Bible tells us to pray without ceasing, the intention is that everyone prays without ceasing, not just one person. We all do it together. So that's why we're doing a series together, because we want to do this all together. You think about the most meaningful times of spiritual growth in your life, I bet it was with other people, right? So let's do it together. All right, second thing that I want to say. We're not just doing it with other people. We're not just building loving attachment with the community. We're also doing it with God, right? And here's the thing, Christian change is unlike any other change because there's power. The Spirit helps us. You see, when we make God our object, when we make Jesus the object of our loves, he becomes subject. In other words, he becomes the subject in the grammatical sentence of every formational endeavor that we do, that we partake in. That means that he exerts his power on us. That means that when we love him, he is already loving us. He loves us first. The Spirit helps us in our weakness. As one theologian puts it, that Jesus lives means that there is a subject who has us as his object. And how many of you know that when that subject has us as objects, we will change? We will change, make no mistake about it, because the Spirit helps us in our weakness. In fact, one of the ways that these spiritual disciplines or these spiritual practices have been labeled is they've been labeled means of grace. What does that mean? That means that practices are a way that we tap into the power of the Spirit, power to change. They're means that we receive grace. They're means that we receive power. They are the way that we sit under the stream of the soaking powerful work of the Spirit. And friends, let me tell you, when you sit under the influence of the Spirit, you will change. You will change. And that's why these practices take time. What are these practices about? They are about getting near Jesus. How many of you know that when you get near somebody, you become like that person? How many of you know married couples that look exactly alike? Anyone know people like that? I know people like that. I know married people that the older they get, the more they look the same. Well, why does that happen? Because when you spend time with somebody, you become like that person. And now you're going to tell me, I don't know that I believe in this whole Christian change stuff. I don't know that I'll really change. Well, let me tell you, when you get near Jesus, you will change. Because he is the most important and most powerful being in the universe. And he wants to spend time with you. Because he knows that when he spends time with you, you will be a different person after it. And not only will you be a different person, your heart will change. Your desires will change. You know, like when I was in my early 20s, I found myself in the throes of an addiction. I tried to do everything I could to change. Anytime I had a slip up, I would say, okay, I'm going to put more money in the offering bucket. And all that did was make me real poor. And like I practiced radical transparency. I beat myself up, but none of those things worked. And so I said, you know what I'm going to do? I read a book, and the book said a lot of these things, and I'm going to do what this book said, and I'm just going to turn my eyes and my heart and my whole posture and my life to the way of life of Jesus and do these practices and do them with other people and do them in the power of the Spirit. And guess what happened after I did all of that? My heart changed. My heart changed. My desires changed. I became the kind of person that didn't want to do the thing that I was addicted to anymore. I changed. And so this is all we're inviting you to do over the next 8 to 9 weeks. We're just saying, hey, we believe in this. We believe that if you will actually do the things that Jesus did, we believe that you will get near to Jesus. We believe that you will attach to Jesus. And we believe that your love will change. And after all, love is where change happens. Heart is where change happens. They actually work. And so I know it's summer, and I know it's Chicago, and I know that we spend 9 months inside, and I know that those 9 months inside are like the worst 9 months of our lives, and I know that we catch all sorts of viruses, and I know that when summer comes and the beach beckons, and all the sports are being played, the last thing that you want to do is be here. I know that. It's like we awaken to a different kind of life in the summer. But let me invite you, maybe this summer, before you head to the beach, come here. Come here. That's right. Amen.